Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Quote, on September 1st, 1894, we will not renew our loans under any consideration. On September 1st, we will demand our money. We will foreclose and become mortgagees in possession. We can take 2/3 of the farms west of the Mississippi and thousands of them east of the Mississippi as well at our own price. Then the farmers will become tenants as in England. End quote. American Bankers Association, 1891, as printed in the Congressional Record of April 29, 1913.
That powerful and shocking bit of American history, read by our commentator Bob Bowes, should be a bracing reminder to you that, as we heard in our last program, the banks own the place, that place being Congress. Bob will be along later in the program with his full commentary, which deals with the strategic savaging of our democracy early on by banking interests from our earliest days. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor and Chair Emeritus at the Public Banking Institute. Today, we're going to consider a number of issues related to our predicament as debt slaves to the private capital cartels from whom we borrow our money. That America was weaseled into handing over our constitutional right to create our own money through our public treasury has made all the difference in our economy and in every aspect of American life. Under this regime of private issuance of money, the money lenders keep each of us on a tight leash of indebtedness, driven by their insatiable profiteering interests. When we talk about creating public banks, we're talking about transforming that debtor's position into more of a democratically controlled, utilitarian-focused credit issuance system. We're going to address a key aspect of that situation with Ellen as she talks to our guest Thomas Hanna of the Democracy Collaborative, who has a new book coming out called Our Commonwealth, and who recently published a timely article that addresses what many fear is the probable repeat of the 2008 financial collapse. Thomas's article is called The Crisis Next Time, Planning for Public Ownership as an Alternative to Corporate Bank Bailouts. The question before us is whether there's sufficient public knowledge and political will to prevent the banking lobby-driven Congress from handing over trillions more of our dollars to prop up their preposterous and risky business activities, which privatizes profit while socializing losses on the backs of American citizens. The public banking movement in the U.S. is putting some flesh on those bones of the efforts to reclaim public control of our money. It's one of the most strategically important steps that we can take to wrest some control from Wall Street. Later on in today's program, we'll hear about a new citizen training program that's designed to make lasting changes in democratizing local government leadership. Our guest is Anna Callahan of the Incorruptibles, a growing national education effort that trains citizens to create lasting political change through smart and steady political organizing. It's not hard to do once you get the picture that taking power for the people locally demands a steadfast posture and a wise plan. Anna will be along a little later in the program. But now let's go to that conversation between Ellen and Thomas Hanna of the Democracy Collaborative.
I'm speaking with with Thomas Hanna, who is Research Director for the Democracy Collaborative, working with Gar Alperovitz, who we've interviewed here before and had as a conference speaker and admire greatly. Thomas, too, is an accomplished writer, having published in many places, and currently has a new book out called Our Commonwealth, The Return of Public Ownership in the United States. It was just published in the UK and will be available here in the US shortly. So, Thomas, it's great to speak to you.
Hi, Ellen. Thanks for having me.
So the piece I wanted to talk about, which is right up our alley here at the Public Banking Institute, was one you published in July called The Crisis Next Time, Planning for Public Ownership as an Alternative to Corporate Bank Bailouts. I think you've made some excellent suggestions in there for what we can do about, well, you start with the premise that there will be another financial crisis and build from there. So why are you fairly certain there will be another one?
Yeah, so we're sitting here right now talking at almost exactly the 10-year anniversary of the last financial crisis, the great financial crisis and the recession that followed it. And in the modern era, the sort of neoliberal era, as we like to say, financial crises happen on average every 10 years. So right now, 10 years in, we are at the point where we should start really be thinking very strategically about the possibility of another financial crisis and one that may happen relatively soon. You know, in history, financial crises are very common. You know, we always like to think that there won't be another financial crisis, but there always is one, despite, you know, things that we try to do like Dodd-Frank and financial reform. You know, what we don't know is that where the next financial crisis will come from. We don't know how severe it will be. We don't know what sector it will come from, but that there will be another financial crisis is fairly uncontroversial in the sector. And as I said earlier, you know, we put in place financial regulation after the last financial crisis, the Dodd-Frank Reform Act. But that reform legislation, I think universally, most people understand that it's relatively weak. It's much weaker than the financial reform legislation that was put in place after the Great Depression and after the financial crisis in 1929. And not only was it weak to start with, but it's been significantly weakened over the past 10 years by the banking industry and their lobbyists and their allies on Capitol Hill and their allied politicians, to the point where I don't believe, and I don't think many serious observers believe, that the financial reform legislation will prevent another financial crisis. The banks are still too big to fail. In fact, they're bigger than they were in 2007. The sector is more consolidated. The shadow banking sector is more risky. So I think we need to really start thinking about what happens in the next financial crisis when that comes. Do we just bail out the banks like we did last time, or do we want to take a new approach? And that new approach, I think, is the crux of what I was writing about in this report, and that is instead of bailing out the banks, we should develop now a plan for long-term public ownership of those banks.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. And the problem with the, among other problems with Dodd-Frank, was that it didn't hit what actually caused the crisis, which was a collapse in the shadow banking system. And I saw where, like, Larry Fink's BlackRock is now, I think, manages something like $5 trillion dollars in investments, so that's all the pension funds, etc. And he managed to, they debated regulating the shadow banks, and he talked them out of it. And some people think that's where the next big crisis is liable to happen. I mean, the banks recognize that they're getting sort of over-regulated as proper banks, so they're kind of moving into the shadow banking system. So yeah, I totally agree. Things will come to a head. Also, I don't think regulation is going to work. We've been trying to regulate the banks for two centuries, and it hasn't really worked. So what do you think about the current proposals like breaking up the banks and, you know, reimposing Glass-Steagall, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. You make an excellent point about, you know, attempting to regulate the banks for many centuries. And what you actually find is that if you look at the regulation that was put in place, Glass-Steagall, after the 1929 crash and the Great Depression, it took a very long time. It was strong legislation to start with, and it took a very long time for it to be unwound and eventually repealed. But it was a very, very slow process of chipping away, and deregulating, and breaking off pieces of Glass-Steagall, and weakening it over time. And then if you contrast that with Dodd-Frank started off as a weaker piece of legislation, and it was weakened and chipped away at much more quickly. So what we're looking at now is the power of the banking industry. In the 20th century, that was one thing. It took them decades to deregulate and finally do away with Glass-Steagall. The power of the banking industry now is so much more pronounced, so much stronger, that they were able to do away with Dodd-Frank much quicker than they were able to do away with Glass-Steagall.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that neither approach ultimately is the solution. Or, I mean, even some people think we need to go back to Glass-Steagall, but even if we could do it, it doesn't seem to me it would work. I mean, the whole point of it, basically the government was saying, well, we'll insure the deposits of, the people, but we're not going to insure the speculative stuff, so you got to split that stuff off. But deposits really aren't enough to run a banking system. I mean, you need the ability to borrow on the shadow. I mean, they now do borrow heavily on the shadow. Banks borrow heavily in the shadow banking system. So even if you reimposed it, it seems to me it would not solve the problem.
Yeah, I agree. It wouldn't solve the problem. And you asked before about breaking them up as well as sort of the other institutional strategy that's been proposed, so re-regulating them on the one hand, breaking them up on the other hand. And I think you have a similar problem in terms of the concentrated power in the sector. And if you look at antitrust enforcement over the past several decades in general, there's been a trajectory away from robust antitrust enforcement. And the last company that was even broken up was, I think, AT&T in the 1980s. And, it's been, quote unquote, domesticated. And so I don't think there's a lot of possibility there either for breaking up the big banks in the current context. I think what I would argue and what I did argue in this paper is that you need to get control of these institutions first, and then you can possibly break them up. But you're not going to do anything while they're still in private control. I think their power is just too concentrated and too vast.
Yeah, excellent point. So you say that outright public ownership is the most immediately viable and perhaps the only effective option. So do you want to go into your vision of what outright public ownership looks like?
Yeah, I think for me, I don't think public ownership immediately, right now, today, tomorrow is viable. I don't think the Republican Congress and Donald Trump is just going to sign off on some legislation nationalizing or taking over all of the big banks. I think that would be quite optimistic, to say the least. But I think my point is that a crisis is an opportunity. It's a crisis, but it is also an opportunity. In the last crisis, there was an opportunity to restructure the financial system, somewhat akin to the opportunity in 1929 to restructure the financial system that basically put in place a new regulatory regime that lasted several decades. President Obama and the administration that was in place in 2008 and 2009 didn't take that opportunity. They did not fundamentally restructure the banks. They bailed them out. They gave them a lot of free money. They messed around the edges. They did quasi-nationalizations and bailouts, and it was really messy and not transparent, and it pretty much proved all of the worst things that are told about government intervention into markets, because they were trying to avoid any semblance of actually having to say that they were nationalizing or taking control of these banks. In another crisis, when the banks really need money, they need to be saved, they're crashing and burning, and the government has to step in, that's the opportunity to do things differently, to not just give them free money, not just to bail them out, but to basically take them into public ownership, to condition any money that we give them on them giving us voting rights and ownership stakes along with those voting rights. And then to think differently about sort of the long-term prospects of what we do with those banks once we've taken them into public ownership. Because in the last financial crisis, there were definitely people who were saying, okay, let's nationalize these failing banks, pretty mainstream economists. But they were pretty universal in their desire to just see this be a short-term thing. They didn't they were sort of bought into the whole neoliberal pre-2007 ideology that really thought that long-term public ownership of banks was crazy. It was inefficient. You know, you didn't want government running banks. However, obviously, the financial crisis has proved some of that ideology incorrect, but also that ideology is premised on incorrect assumptions. If you actually look at the empirical and theoretical research, you don't find much support for this theory that private is inherently more efficient than public. So I think the next crisis is going to be an opportunity for that, to think differently, not only about taking ownership stakes, but also long-term, if we want to keep these things in public control and what we want to do with them if we were going to keep them in public control.
Yep, I agree with all that too. And it's, I mean, I've been saying that too, that we can make these proposals and no legislator is bringing a bill about that right now. But when we do have another crisis, they'll be looking around like, now what do we do? And those ideas will be out there. Well, it's just like public banking in general, getting that idea out there, then legislators are more receptive to it because they've at least seen it. And it seems to me the next time we can say, well, you tried A, B, and C the last time and that didn't work. So now we have to go to something else. And there's also just a lot more, the climate is just getting more receptive to the idea of public ownership in general. People are fed up with this whole neoliberal privatization thing, seems to me. So I agree.
Yeah, exactly. And if you actually look at the polling that was done during the last financial crisis and the subsequent years, the American people hate bank bailouts. I mean, they loathe and detest them. You know, there was polling done. There was polling done in the last financial crisis that the American public, a majority, actually would rather have taken the banks into public ownership, temporary public ownership, mind you, but public ownership rather than give them conditionless bank bailouts, just free money. In the next financial crisis, you know, that may be something to build on, to move forward on. So maybe we can move from that to convincing the majority of people that, okay, so rather than temporary public ownership, maybe we want longer-term public ownership for some of these institutions, and maybe we want to get these institutions aligned with certain things that we as a society need to confront and need to do.
Yeah, and apparently the big objection to national, I mean, there was talk of nationalizing the banks. Obama was talking about it, but apparently the big objection was that then you'd have to take on these bad debts of these big banks, and the government would have to pay those off. But so how would you address that? I have an answer.
Well, I'd love to hear your answer first, Ellen, and then I'll give mine. How about that?
Okay. Well, this is actually Richard Werner's answer. He's in a UK professor. He says that various times in history that you don't have to pay off the debts. What you do is you have your central bank buy them off the bank, and then the central bank can, just like the Federal Reserve did, bought these toxic assets without actually calling them toxic, but everybody knew that they weren't going to fetch on the market what the Fed actually paid for them. And apparently that's been done a couple of other times historically, once in Japan after 1945, and in the UK around World War I, where they just didn't want to be saddled with, they didn't want the banks to go down, and they didn't want to be saddled with these big debts, so they just moved them on to the central bank or wrote them off.
Yeah, I think we're broadly aligned there. I think that's what I would assume as well. I mean, we all know that the government did that with the banks during the last financial crisis in terms of taking the toxic assets off of their balance sheets and bringing them onto the government's books. There's no reason, I think, why then the government could then just, you know, cancel those debts or restructure them in some way. We also need to remember, as you well know, that the government also, in addition to bailing out all these banks, just did about, you know, $3+ trillion in new money creation through their quantitative easing program as well. So there's capacity there in the system at that time, during a crisis time, to do more interesting things with the central bank in terms of some of these debts as well.
Yeah, the Fed could have bought Lehman Brothers. Or, you know, they could have fixed things right there around September 15th of 2008, but But they said, no, sorry, we can't do that. And then a couple weeks later, they said, well, okay, we can do it. And then they said,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing what you can do with the political will. To kind of change the subject, we're just finding that here in Los Angeles. I guess you know about Charter Amendment B, where the city council has put on the ballot to have the voters approve whether the city could form a municipal bank, a city-owned bank. And he's gotten pushed back various times, and he just is plowing forward, which is great. You know, that's what you need, somebody who's willing to take on the challenge and just do it. He says, well, California leads the nation, and this is something that needs to be done, and I know I'm putting my reputation on the line, but I think it's important, and we're going to do it. So you just need to find somebody like that.
Exactly, and I've made this point a couple times, but you know, I always find it very illustrative of comparing the financial crash of 1929 to the most recent one in 2008, 2009, and you know, FDR's response as compared to President Obama's response. And you know, FDR did push ahead despite the pushback, despite a powerful banking lobby, and put in some structural reforms. Obviously, I don't think those FDR's reforms went far enough, obviously, but you know, they are much more, they were much stronger than the reforms in the Dodd-Frank legislation that ended up going through after during President Obama's term.
Yeah, and he took the dollar off the gold standard, and people said, can he do that? But
yeah,
he did it. And in fact, the Bank of North Dakota, which is our one and only U.S. public model that's been around for any length of time, it was started by just a very dynamic leader that got the people riled up and said, we can do this, and they did it.
The Bank of North Dakota, and I'll just tie in with some other stuff from my public ownership book more generally, you know, that political atmosphere in the Midwest around that time in the 1910s and 1920s, a sort of agrarian populist socialist tradition is very interesting in some of the longstanding institutions that it was able to get into the economic landscape and have been preserved over time. So in addition to the Bank of North Dakota, North Dakota also has a large mill and elevator for the processing of grain for small farmers, because they were being sort of held hostage to the grain monopolies and the railroad monopolies and the Wall Street bankers who were financing those monopolies. So they decided to have a publicly owned grain and mill, and that still operates to this day. You know, in Wisconsin, neighboring Wisconsin, they have a state-run, publicly-owned life insurance program that dates back, about the same time. Once you get these things, I think one of the lessons of public ownership in the United States is once you're able to fight the fight and get these institutions in place, and once they survive the initial, onslaught from Wall Street or from private interests, if they get established in the economic landscape, they become pretty resilient and they become pretty popular. And they can last for 100 years, as the banks of North Dakota and the mill and the life insurance in Wisconsin as well. They can last for decades and decades and withstand efforts to try and privatize them. And they're sort of very inculcated from the sort of larger national policy debates about privatization and nationalization. They're just what works and on the local level and broadly popular.
Mm-hmm. So go into some of your broader topics that you cover in your new book.
Yes. The book is called Our Commonwealth, The Return of Public Ownership in the United States. And the book essentially takes a look at the United States, maybe like me, you, and maybe some of the listeners, kind of think of the United States as the beating heart of free market capitalism, where, everything is private and corporations run everything. And I think to an extent that is correct. But because of the way the U.S. political system is structured, because it's more decentralized than some other countries that have more centralized systems, there's actually a lot more interesting experimentation with alternative ownership forms on the ground than in some of these other countries. And I tell this to friends and colleagues in other countries, and they get astounded by sort of the breadth of public ownership in the United States. So, for instance, we have about 2,000 publicly owned electric utilities that, along with cooperatives, provide around 25% of the nation's electricity. So I wrote an article, I think, like 2015 or so, and I'd been studying this for a couple years, and I randomly came across the fact that in Nebraska, the state of Nebraska, which is a very politically conservative state, every single resident and business receives their electricity from a publicly owned utility or a cooperative. The entire state There's no privately owned utilities, and this goes back as well to what we were talking about this different political atmosphere in the early 20th century. Around 90%, I think 85, 90% of the U.S. population is served by local publicly owned water systems, which if you go to the U.K. or some of these other countries, that's astounding. You know, the U.K. has privatized its entire water system, and they're having terrible trouble with that, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of activist movement around trying to reverse that in the UK. Nearly all public transportation systems in the US, buses, subways, trams, are in public ownership. And again, this is very different from some other countries.
That's interesting. We just put up the facade, really, of being capitalist.
I read
somewhere that on average, you know, half of every government or every whatever is public and half is private. But it's just a matter of what they put in the public sector and what they put in the private sector. What we tend to put in our public sector is the military. People don't really think of the military as being government-owned, but it is, and it's gigantic.
You know, I think what's interesting in the U.S. experience is that because we have these different levels of government, local, you know, regional, sort of a state or federal, you know, you actually have quite a lot of things in public ownership across those three levels that you wouldn't really think of being in public ownership. You know, like airports, commercial airports. You know, every commercial airport by law has to be publicly owned. You know, other countries, they privatize their airports. You know, I think one of the ones that I find really interesting is that these sovereign wealth funds that are in many Western states. So in Western states, Alaska, for instance, Texas, they have these giant publicly owned funds. So in Texas, they have what's called the Permanent School Fund. I think it's the Texas Permanent School Fund, which basically owns around like 2 million acres of land, as well as mineral and other rights from that land. And they invest that money, and they have a $40 billion a year public fund, which owns stocks, bonds, lands, other assets. And they take about $1 billion a year in dividends out of that fund, and they use it to subsidize their public education system. Every single county in the state of Texas gets money every year. So when you have Rick Perry, who comes out and, you know, likes to laud the Texas miracle, which is, you know, high growth that's based upon low taxes, Rick Perry is not telling you that they also have this giant socialist fund, which is used to underwrite social services so that they can keep their taxation low. So a lot of these Western states have these giant sovereign wealth funds. Alaska has one, which is very famous, and they use the dividends from those funds to give basically a basic income to every resident in the state of Alaska. If you're a resident of the state of Alaska, every year you get a certain amount of money, $1,000 or something. So for a family of four, maybe $4,000 or $5,000 every year just from being a resident of the state of Alaska out of this giant publicly owned fund.
Wow, that's really interesting. So what would be your, like, ultimate vision for, if you could redesign the whole system, how would you integrate public and private?
I focus a lot in my work on different ownership forms, as you can imagine. So I would come about it looking at, you know, what I would probably call democratic ownership. So a system where democratized forms of ownership eventually supersede and displace the dominant corporate capitalist extractive model that exists in our society today. And so that democratic ownership mix of institutions could involve publicly owned enterprises like the ones that we've been talking about. They could involve worker-owned enterprises. They could involve multi-stakeholder enterprises whereby, so maybe workers, consumers, residents, they all own this enterprise together. It could involve nonprofit ownership, community ownership, but together these different forms of alternative ownership come together as one, and they become the dominant paradigm in our society. And then within these enterprises, I also feel that there has to be democratization as well internally. So we've been talking about publicly owned enterprises in the United States, and there's a lot of them, and they're growing in interesting areas, especially around things like public energy companies and so on and so forth. However, by and large, these institutions internally are just, they're not that interesting. They're very hierarchical. They're, you know, just traditionally structured. What I think we need to do to move forward as a society is to embed democracy more fully within these enterprises as well. So I think there needs to be much more accountability, much more transparency, much more representation of different groups and people within society in the ownership and management of these enterprises.
So would these be like co-ops?
I think cooperatives are part of this mix of institutions, but then cooperatives, in order to be broadly representative of all of society, you know, cooperatives need to internally democratize as well. They need to work on incorporating other perspectives into the internal workings of a cooperative. But I think for publicly owned enterprises, especially because publicly owned enterprises are supposed to represent all of a society or all of a community, they need to be democratized. They need to have the voices of other people, you know, workers, consumers, residents, those experiences and those voices need to be involved in the running and ownership of these publicly owned enterprises. So, you know, in other countries, this could involve putting workers on the board of directors of a publicly owned enterprise, like co-determination in Germany is one example. It could involve having works councils, or could it be having consumer councils, these other bodies within an enterprise that can inform and help the publicly owned enterprise make decisions. It could be, you know, democratic assemblies. There's a really interesting example in Costa Rica called Banco Popular, which is a sort of a hybrid publicly owned enterprise and cooperative. And they have a large 200 and something member assembly where they elect people, you know, residents, workers, you know, get elected to this assembly. And then this assembly then elects, I think, 4 members to the board. And then the government, the state, appoints another 3 members to the board. And they also have a popular planning process where they go through the country every certain amount of years and they do a planning process to see what the bank should be doing. And as a result, this bank, which is, I think, like the 3rd or 4th largest bank in Costa Rica, has become one of the most ecologically green-centered banks, because that's what the people and the assembly, that's what they've decided to concentrate on. And so it's a really interesting example of how you can increase democracy, participation, accountability, and transparency within a bank and within a publicly owned enterprise more generally.
Wow, I'm going to have to buy your book when it comes online. It sounds pretty interesting. Yeah, I've written about the Costa Rican banking system before, and how, I guess, in the 1940s that there was a revolution and that new president got rid of the military altogether because he didn't trust them, and socialized or nationalized many things, including the banks, and it worked out really well. I think what maybe one reason is that Costa Rica didn't have it, doesn't, you know, it grows coffee, but it doesn't have oil or minerals or things that foreign countries want to exploit away. And so it could set up a socialist system and nobody really complained about it because nobody really cared. You know what I mean?
I agree. And you know, I think one of the interesting things about public ownership now is that for much of the 20th century, you know, public ownership was caught in this titanic ideological struggle between capitalism on the one hand and communism on the other hand, to the point where, you know, it was really reduced. Economies were really reduced to this very simplistic dichotomy, you know, complete private ownership on the one hand, complete state ownership on the other hand. But in reality, every economy has a mix of different ownership forms. You know, there's no pure system or pure model. You know, as we've just been talking about, the United States has abundant public ownership, you know, and then, you know, you have some of these other countries that you would consider to be more social democratic, which has robust private sectors as well. So I think one of the interesting things about moving the 21st century and since the fall of the Soviet Union has been, it's really been able to free up public ownership from this struggle to the point where we can start talking realistically about truly what the merits are of different types of ownership in an economy, and also really start to dive in, especially since the financial crisis. We've now been able to really start to talk about the actual experience and actual literature on efficiency and on comparative efficiency, because, you know, the whole there is no alternative mantra of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan is really built on a myth. It's a red herring. It's this idea that, you know, the private is superior, and the literature never spoke with one voice on this. And that now I think people's eyes have been opened up by the financial crisis 10 years ago, and it's much easier now to discuss this, and people, as you know, in the public banking movement are much more amenable to other forms of ownership, you know, once the wool was pulled out from under their eyes from all the big banks crashing 10 years ago.
Right. It's the millennials who have really been the motivating force here in Los Angeles, and they're quite, you know, many of them are are members of the Socialist Party or Democratic Socialist or something. You know, socialism is not a bad word among the younger generation.
Yeah, I agree. And again, this is, you know, this is a generation that has grown up. They didn't grow up when there was a Soviet Union. There's not that those old sort of accusations, the red baiting, they just don't apply anymore because they've grown up with a capitalism, only capitalism, and a type of capitalism, the corporate capitalism that we have, that's really failed them on many accounts. You know, not just the financial crisis, but you know, with student debt, home ownership, you know, the everything that we were told about the benefits of capitalism. You know, it sort of rings hollow for many people, especially of this new generation.
Yeah, I agree. They came into the world cheated out of their legacy. So
exactly.
I'm not real happy with the powers that, as they exist today. Well, that's been all really interesting. Tell people where to find your work.
Sure, yeah. As you said at the beginning, I'm the research director at the Democracy Collaborative, which is an organization, an R&D lab for a more democratic economy, as we like to say, that's based out of both Washington, D.C. and Cleveland, Ohio. And we work with a variety of different organizations and partners on the ground. You can find me at democracycollaborative.org. Or you can find my book, it's Our Commonwealth, The Return of Public Ownership in the United States. It's published by Manchester University Press in the UK and Oxford University Press in the United States. It should be out in the US probably by the end of October, beginning of November. And I will be traveling around a little bit in November, December, promoting the book and doing public presentations. So I may be coming to a town near some of your listeners.
Maybe Los Angeles. All right. It's been great talking to you. And good luck with your book. It sounds really good.
Great. Thank you so much, Ellen, for having me.
Ellen has been speaking with Thomas Hanna, Research Director of the Democracy Collaborative and author of a new book entitled Our Commonwealth. And you can read his full report on The Crisis Next Time at democracycollaborative.org. Now it's time to look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with Bob Bowes. Bob has been taking us on a chapter-by-chapter pilgrimage through his new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, in which he lays out the historic backdrop that has shaped our system of finance and our democracy. Today, Step 5, Restoring Democracy.
As Benjamin Franklin once noted, the principal cause of the American Revolutionary War was the British Parliament, at the behest of the Anglo-Euro banking cartel, banning the paper currency issued by all 13 colonies and making British gold and silver coins the only legal tender. After General George Washington and his troops defeated the mercenaries employed by the British bankers on the battlefields, the British quickly struck back, sabotaging the new nation from within. The initial two blows consisted of, first, replacing the Articles of Confederation with the U.S. Constitution, thus beginning the consolidation and usurpation of power at the federal level, and second, with the establishment of Alexander Hamilton's First Bank of the United States and, in its demise, the establishment of the Second Bank of the United States, both owned and operated by the bankers who controlled Britain and other key European countries. These twin offensives positioned the cartel to focus on controlling individuals serving within the District of Columbia, particularly those serving in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, thus gaining the power to pass legislation to force the nation into debt slavery. In the beginning, it was a seesaw battle, with Madison and Jackson, respectively, refusing to renew the charters of the two British-controlled central banks, the first resulting in the War of 1812, and the second resulting in a depression and over half a dozen unsuccessful attempts on Jackson's life. This takeover strategy via debt slavery was continued during the middle of the 19th century, with the private banking cartel encouraging and funding large, ill-advised public works projects using the successful Erie Canal bond sale and construction model as the hook. The cartel's sordid and perverse strategies continued with three successful assassinations of U.S. presidents in the 19th century, as well as the continued targeting of congressmen with bribes and threats against their lives and families. This control over Congress most prominently figured in the prohibition of sovereign currency, Lincoln's greenbacks, and the passage of the National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. These bank-sponsored laws force government to issue U.S. Treasury bonds on which it pays principal and interest for the privilege of receiving private banknotes in return. By the late 19th century, with the Gilded Age in full parasitic bloom, the robber barons' arrogance knew no bounds. They considered it fashionable to be forthcoming in revealing what had been their true intentions all along. Quote, "On September 1, 1894, we will not renew our loans under any consideration. On September 1st, we will demand our money. We will foreclose and become mortgagees in possession. We can take 2/3 of the farms west of the Mississippi and thousands of them east of the Mississippi as well at our own price. Then the farmers will become tenants as in England." End quote. American Bankers Association, 1891, as printed in the Congressional Record of April 29, 1913. 19 years after this declaration of war on the people of the United States of America, after demonetizing silver and enforcing a decades-long depression, the Federal Reserve Act was passed, when most of Congress had left on Christmas vacation, on the premise that it would stabilize the economy. With that action, the U.S. officially lost its sovereignty because this unconstitutional law claims to prohibit the country from creating its own money. Since that day, 105 years ago, the banking cartel has crashed the nation's economic system on the average of every 5 1/3 years to destroy value created by labor, so that the unaudited money that they issue to buy up global assets does not cause hyperinflation. As we have seen with the worldwide Occupy Wall Street movement and massive demonstrations over various issues, many of which are never reported in the corporate media, there are tens of millions of people ready to act. But the effectiveness of such actions wholly depends on focusing on the root cause, private control over money creation, as we have demonstrated here, and avoiding the dissipation of our energies on peripheral issues that depend on sovereign control over money creation to be successfully addressed. So, in our next installment, Step 6, Restoring Law, Science, and Logic, we will outline actions that can serve as educational tools which will facilitate the unmasking of the tentacles of power wielded by a small group of people who control the world's key central banks, corporations, and governments. From behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Bob Bowes' new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your local booksellers. With a name like the Incorruptibles, you might expect some righteous do-gooders to be setting a stage for political impurity purges. But with the phrase, incorruptible politicians are not born, they're made, this new group, the Incorruptibles, intends to train citizens in how to take back control of their local governments. Anna Callahan, the executive director of the Incorruptibles, is far from an ideological Puritan. She's a former IT engineer from Silicon Valley who realized that what was taking place politically in America was a losing battle against powerful interests relentlessly undermining public interests, in much the same way as we discuss the private monetary regime. She joined us to talk about how their training program helps establish local political strategies that result in an ongoing and resilient public empowerment with public policy.
FDR transformed the civic environment and the economic environment from the top down. He had enough courage to be able to implement ideas and to see them through politically. This is a different creature that you're creating here. This is speaking to what presumably you must feel is a corrupted environment of politics, hence the name the Incorruptibles. What's corrupted here fundamentally, and why the name Incorruptible?
There was a study done by Princeton, some Princeton researchers, over about 20 years of policy passed at the national level. So they looked at policies that passed and policies that failed, like basically everything that went through Congress, I think about 2,000 different bills. And they looked at how popular they were among the bottom 90% of wage earners, and then how likely they were to pass. And you would hope that the more people liked the bill, the more popular it was, the more likely it would be to pass, and that if everybody hated it, it wouldn't pass. But in fact, the shocking thing about this study is that there was no difference at all. So if everyone in the bottom 90% of wage earners hated a bill, it had a 30% chance of passing. If everyone loved it, it had a 30% chance of passing. If 50% of people loved it, 50% hated it, it was like a flat line. Wow. It was a 30% chance of passing, and it didn't matter whether we, the people, wanted it or didn't want it. But if you looked at the top 10%, anything they hated got vetoed, and things that they liked were very likely to pass. You know, when we talk about corrupted, we're not talking about what's legal or what's illegal. Like, unfortunately, corruption, as far as the colloquial meaning, what we all mean by corruption, has become legal, right? So it's perfectly legal for companies to pour money into politicians and expect them to vote the way that that company wants. That's just the way that our politics works. And so the name, the Incorruptibles, you know, it's hard to find, names are hard, right? It's hard to find a name that agrees with people who are in the bottom 75% of wage earners, because it's been drilled into us that we should be either on the left or on the right. We should be either red or blue, like this sort of team spirit that unfortunately both red and blue, both the Democratic and Republican parties, have become corrupted, and they represent the people at the top. We just picked that name because we felt like, you know what, this is something that all Americans can get behind, that we don't want our government to be representing, and it really isn't the top 10%. It's really the top 1% or the top 0.1% that kind of control our government, and that's what Bernie means when he talks about an oligarchy.
Right. So that big money, the Koch brothers, you know, just one example, certainly from that side of the spectrum, and I would say some people would say, well, there's Soros, et cetera, on the other side. Your effort is a kind of a bipartisan opportunity for purification. Is that right?
And we'd say multi-partisan.
A multi-party.
About half of the electorate does not belong to either political party, which is very low. It's another way of kind of telling the discontent that people have. It's gone down and down, and now it's like not half the people don't belong to a political party.
So clearly then your effort is not a partisan focused one, but tell us how Incorruptibles works. What's the strategy here? What are people getting involved with by getting connected with the Incorruptible strategy?
Well, I'm going to first touch on something that you alluded to about how FDR kind of did things from the top down and how we're different. We fundamentally believe that there will be no strong progressive movement in this country until the decision-making power is given to people at the grassroots. That's like a fundamental belief of ours, that no top-down organization, no nonprofit, no 501c4, like political action committee, none of those groups, if they're just a bunch of staff people making all the decisions and then telling people what to do, that is not the way a movement's going to happen. So what we do is go from city to city, and we train people in a new model of political organizing that puts them the decision-making seat. Everyone else in political training world is training candidates how to get elected and training people how to help with campaigns. And what we do is we help people understand how to build power in between campaigns. So I'll dive into a little bit about our model, because it really was born from this incredible David and Goliath story that came out of Richmond, California. The city of Richmond, California, was basically owned by Chevron for about 100 years. There's a large oil refinery there, and Chevron poured money into the political process. They even had a desk inside City Hall. The refinery would, every 5 years or so, would have a spill or an explosion or something that would send hundreds of people to the hospital and damage the environment. There were almost never any sort of lawsuits about that from the city. And like most corrupt cities, it also had a lot of other problems. So it had the second highest homicide rate in the country. It had a terrible police brutality problems in a predominantly African-American and Latino city. And a bunch of other problems. You know, it was really a troubled place. So in 2003, a bunch of residents got together and, you know, they decided that they weren't going to take it anymore, basically. But they used a very different model of organizing. And over the next 8 or 10 years, they completely took over the city council. And by that, I mean that they got mayor and a majority and then a supermajority, and they maintain a supermajority on the city council to this day.
And so your methodology is to enable citizens individually, but also collectively, to strategize a new way forward. The second workshop in your series of four that you're offering is called Strategize Your County.
Yeah, this is our flagship workshop. We usually call it Strategize Your City. One of the great things about the Richmond Progressive Alliance model is that instead of focusing on individual candidates, they focus on an entire electoral body. I know tons of groups that focus on candidates, and like you pick a few, you might pick, you know, one or two for city council and one for your state assembly and one for your state senate and, you know, one for Congress. And let's say every one of those people wins. And let's say even by some miracle, they all stay true to their political promises and that they remain engaged with you, with the people. They're probably going to be outnumbered by pro-corporate, pro-billionaire forces in every political body, which means they won't be able to pass anything. The way the Richmond Progressive Alliance found out, like their model, part of what's really great about their model is that you focus on a whole political body and you strategize around taking over the political body, which means 50% or more. Because once you have 50% of your city council, man, there are a lot of things you can pass. You could have a municipal bank.
Right. Yeah.
So that's part of it. And then in our workshop, which is about 3 hours, but during that 3 hours, we walk through all the different, we call them the five pillars, that people need to think about and to strategize around in order to have a plan for taking over that electoral body. We definitely believe, like many others, that money in politics is a huge problem and a huge reason for the corruption that exists in our government today. But in our talks with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, we've also realized that that isn't the only thing. You know, there's a reason why the adage is power corrupts and not money corrupts. So we believe that there would still be corruption even if we took money out of politics. Of course, money out of politics is the first thing to get rid of. So don't get me wrong. Like, we're big about getting money out of politics. So our small dollar donations workshop is about how you can transform your fundraising away from the type of fundraising, the whole system of fundraising where you're calling people on the phone and asking them for money, and into a system where it's really based on, you know, larger events and things that you can do where you're not sort of beholden to the people that have donated to you. And I want to throw in one little thing. We love to think about like systemic change rather than like just making a change for making it. And currently at the national level, congressmen and senators spend approximately 4 hours a day. And that's more for people who are incumbents. But even more than that, sometimes their entire time is spent doing something called call time. And call time means they walk into a booth, like a little cubicle. They're given a list of donors, millionaires and billionaires. And they just have to, they're just on the phone begging for money and listening to the concerns of these people all day long. Ends up with a system where you're trapped into becoming one of these people who is, unfortunately, corrupt. And we use that word generally, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a bad person to be corrupt. You could be a very good person, but you're trapped in the system where you have to raise the money. And if you don't, some horrible guy, is your opponent, who's going to be way worse than you, is going to be in office. So you really are trapped. But that's what we talk about in this Raising Small Dollar Donations workshop, is like, how can you prevent yourself from ending up in that situation and set yourself up from the beginning as a city councilor to be doing the types of events where people are going to donate to you?
Is it important to renounce corporate dollars or large donations?
Yes.
It is.
It is absolutely crucial. Yes, it is absolutely crucial to renounce corporate donations. We're of the belief that corporations are not people. Money is not speech. And, you know, I think every normal human being knows those things. It's just the weird people on our Supreme Court and corrupt people on our Supreme Court who, you know, half of whom have managed to push this through as if it were logical.
Well, it sounds like also systemically from an electoral process that it also changes the environment for citizens to know that their participation at whatever level of their financial means is central to the fabric of the electoral process.
Absolutely. And we train people in a specific kind of event that not only encourages people to donate, but where the candidate is spending, at these events, the candidate spends 70% of the time listening, asking direct questions about specific policies and listening to personal stories about how these policies have affected people's lives. Because, you know, what we're trying to do is turn over the call time way of doing things where the problem isn't just the money. The problem is you're spending 4, 5, 6 hours a day listening to the concerns of a particular type of person, the ultra-wealthy, right? Our politicians, we believe that 50% of a politician's time should be spent listening to their constituents, actively listening, but not listening to the 1%, going to the vulnerable, going to students at a college, going to a coal mining town, going to a Native American reservation, going to a PTA to find out from, you know, parents of public school children, and specifically asking them questions about how their lives are impacted by policies, that the listening is as important as the money. So that's kind of our approach.
Yeah, and your final seminar workshop is called Convincing Coalition Partners, which is certainly spot on with that the fastest way, you say, to build the power you need to win elections comes from working with or connecting yourselves with creating a coalition of people. Where do you look for who would be appropriate to this citizen uprising?
So the very first point that we go over is actually talking about who it is that lives in your city and who are the underserved, right? Who are the populations that are more vulnerable? And for every city, it's going to be different. And we go through like a long list of who these people are, where they live, how could you reach them, and then also what groups are they a part of? And what groups represent them? So often there will be, you know, nonprofits or service organizations or community organizations that represent those people. And so those are often the best places to start.
The start of this, is, I think one of the things that surprised everybody was the power of Bernie's message and the unpredictable amount of power that comes out of the grassroots. Has that been your experience as well around the country?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, we know that the model we teach is very powerful, but it does take time. So it's not the kind of model where you're going to immediately, you know, take over the next year, right? We're actually quite surprised at how quickly people can really succeed when they have a plan.
And certainly indicative of a new level of demand on democracy. I mean, a way for the people to really assume the power and support the outcomes.
Absolutely.
Anna, thank you. Thank you so very much for sharing this and for the good work you're doing to revive our democracy and to hopefully change public policy along the way. Not hopefully. I know you insist on it.
Thank you so much for having me on and for all the work that you do.
That's Anna Callahan, Executive Director of The Incorruptibles at www.theincorruptibles.us. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.